I'd like to talk about the plant mahoi because it's become into my focus as part of the kairongoa kōrero in terms of it's present in the kaituke walkway.
Okay.
But, it, you know, I guess it's like identification.
Yep, because I wouldn't have a clue.
Yeah.
I'm probably the wrong person to ask. I mean, I wouldn't normally
and
know
so,
that much.
It's a very distinctive tree. It's part of a another group of trees which belong to Ngā Tamariki or Mahueka. It's one of the children of the goddess of fire.
Okay.
So, but in terms of its presence in the Kaituke walkway, it's the tree that has splashes of white on the bark, and so it was called whitey wood.
Oh, because Ma is white, is it?
Yeah. Well, yeah. No, the...
the Pākehā. Late.
Yes, that's it.
They called it whitey. That's a kind of a funny name.
And, of course, the botanical name came much later as well through another type of classification. But its original name was Mahoi.
Is Ma white?
Ma does mean white.
But in this case, I'm probably reaching for something that's not there, am I?
You probably are, but yeah, Ma is white.
Because I'd go like Mahoi. Okay, that means white petal.
Yeah, and that's fair enough too.
But I'm ignorant, right? I really don't know what I'm talking about.
But what I wanted to share was the interesting facts that the berries from the Mahoi were mixed with the ashes from the kauri gum.
Yeah.
The kauri gum and was used as a pigment for tamoko. So when you look back to pre-European times, we had a significant body of creating dyes for raranga, for colouring flax, but also in this case for the art of incision into the skin through tamoko.
Does anyone still do that? Does anyone practice that these days?
No, not as far as I know. They don't take the mahoi berries, but I'm sure that there's been some experiments for that, but not officially.
Mm.
No,
yeah.
No, because we have other inks.
It's kind of easier with the modern.
More modern. Did you say?
Yeah, the modern systems. It might be easier.
Yes, but it definitely has a. Sparks an interest in those ingredients, and particularly in this case, the berries of the mahoi, the hua. The leaves were used in a bath in bathing, so it was quite a concentration in rongoa, where the leaves and the small branches and the bark were boiled, or not boiled. I'll take that back, because there was no vessel for boiling as such.
Okay.
Because we didn't have things that you put on the fire that you could boil, like an iron pot.
Okay.
So
the clay pots?
Yes. Uku, Hine Uku is her name, which is the clay. The you know, extensive ranges of clay that we have. Were not fired and used pre-European.
Okay.
As far as I know, as far as I understand. It was Hine Putehue, the gourd, that was water, it could be made watertight. And then kohatu were heated, small particular stones were heated on the fire and put into the hue. To heat the water.
Okay.
Mm.
So that's how it was done.
Quite a process.
Yeah, because if you don't have an iron pot or a glazed pot, that's
what
you
can
do.
Imagine that when the colony arrived, the settler nation, how much we adapted very quickly to, wow, this is magic.
Yeah, yeah.
So, to many of the things that they brought.
But the actual boiling of water would have been, that would have changed the way the process worked, I imagine.
Yes. There were significant places, significant to the iwi, local iwi where they knew where they could boil within the hot pools.
Oh, yeah,
that arrangement, yeah.
Yeah.
Those were very, very much part of a tribal life, those hot pools. And now, of course, it's totally extended and doesn't sit that way anymore. It's got a whole new life and code of practice in terms of the waiwera, the hot pools.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
That's okay. A whole nother topic.
All right, we'll put that one aside. We'll go back to the mahoe.
Yeah, we'll go back to the mahoe. So it was also the leaves were made and drunk as a tea for ikura, which is moon time. And it was also used to treat duodenal ulcers and stomach cancer, which is amazing, really quite an amazing fact. So the duodenum is part of the digestive system.
Okay.
Yeah. So the...
God, I didn't know that.
Yeah, duodenum. So the ulcerated area and obviously stomach being part of the digestive system. So as a rungua for that type of cancer. Hmm. I don't. Yeah.
I guess the diagnosis was a bit different. Like we have scanning devices that can tell us that there's a cancer and can detect it, but without that sort of thing, I guess you've just got symptoms like there's pain or.
That's a very interesting topic. That responsibility was with different tohunga, which were part of the tribe's tribal life.
Yeah.
Had different responsibilities, and one of them was that exactly that diagnosis, and it could be related to makutu, black magic, and it could be of a spiritual nature, emotional body, or it was very much within the body, the physical body itself.
Yeah.
So it wasn't as we have now, which is allopathy, which is Western medicine pays attention to only the physical body?
Yeah, although the science more and more, in fact, continuous stream of information now showing the mind-body connection is substantial.
Yeah, funny that.
Yeah.
And yet it's been around for thousands of years and the indigenous people all over the world would have said, well, yes, of course there is. There is much more than just a physical presence on the earth, and we can tap into those understandings and make a evaluation, if you like, or understand what that ailment is, the nature of it. Not only its nature, but its origins. And therefore they were treated in a certain manner using ceremonially, and ritualistically, which is probably not the best word in terms of te ao Māori, because you go, ooh, rituals,
Yeah.
Because it demotes that practice to where it doesn't sit. It sits in a very highly purification process for the body. That was the tohunga's role, and karakia, invocation, was part of that medicine.
It's interesting because I just mentioned how the modern science has shown that the mind-body connection is such a huge, substantial thing, and it's something that we haven't paid much attention to in the Western world, and now we find ourselves in our lives trying to pay more attention to what our mind is doing and how that might affect us physically, I feel like we're thrashing around in the dark because we just have no, we're just beginners, right? We're just infants. I feel like I'm an infant in that regard, right? Because that my whole background, I've grown up in the Western world, and now I'm trying to make these connections. But you're describing a world where there's a multi-generational tradition and depth of understanding about that connection. And
yeah, we're definitely, in my childhood, we would have this understanding that illness belonged to family groups.
Yeah.
And that there was a reason for that. And it could be like, was definitely related to a breaking of a natural law of tapua noa, and you go, wow, you know, it's in other spaces it would be called the law of karma, cause and effect.
Yeah.
In the Maori world, it was definitely considered, oh well, the whole family is going to suffer for that.
And I think maybe the concept of a curse in English is something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, true. And families, it is actually worth going right into the research and seeing. It does follow with an intergenerational, intergenerational trauma is a factor now discussed heavily.
Everyone understands.
And they go, okay.
But so the Western world, the Western science, didn't you say the Western world, the Western science has viewed what we've just been talking about is all spooky stuff, spooky nonsense, because it couldn't be measured or seen. But now you're talking about intergenerational trauma, and that's put it in terms that Western science can explain.
Yeah, it's just because suddenly
it makes sense again in that worldview.
Yeah, and that's really only because the tools that they were using were limited. They're not mighty tools of like, you've got cancer, you know, to describe that. Yes, that is perhaps what you've got physically, but what is its origins? How did it come about? You know, that just tells us a disease of the body. I'm not saying that just tells us that, but it does have an origin, and that's a fact. And Western medicine will get there. It'll take a long time to...
Well, there's an awful lot of money tied up with treating... we're talking about cancer. There's a lot of money tied up with treating cancer a certain way. Like, it's a huge industry. And as we know in this world, if there's a large industry and a corporate sector involved, it takes a long time to change because they don't want change to happen. And they're very powerful. So that's the world we live in right now.
Well, you know, it serves a great number of scientists and many others to keep us sick. Actually,
illness is really it's an uncomfortable,
not a solution. We're not looking for solutions. We're just diving into research and likely looking in the wrong places.
Yeah, and there are people in the Western world looking in the right places.
Absolutely.
But it always starts on the fringes. People who appear to be, from the middle, they look a little bit crazy. Which they're not. They're not at all. But you know, cause all the new stuff always comes from the fringes.
And I think the whole ideology of proving, and in the in Western science, they go into microbiology, which I think that's where you go.
Yeah.
They say, well, that's where you go. You know, you look into the cellular structure of something and how it behaves, and therefore you can measure different elements. Maori would say that disease or things that trouble the physical body have a personality, and the personality manifests as a fever, not able to eat, blindness, the way the body moves or can't move, and make an assessment based on the way the whole body is behaving. The cellular part of it is really a very small part of what is understood.
Mm.
It's only a minimal part of it. The rest of it is really gives you information in terms of how it was generated.
I think this is something I heard said about modern medicine and modern science. The stuff it does incredibly well. And I think the mistake is to assume that it does everything incredibly well. And it's kind of interesting, like, because what you're talking about has always been viewed as unscientific. I'm doing air quotes, people. But I think what's happened with past cultures is they've just observed the patterns and the connections and the similarities and drawn conclusions from that, which is scientific. That's observation, basis of science. And so I'm kind of interested in I guess the knowledge of how it all developed is kind of lost in time.
Yeah, well, but, and deliberately. So one of the fields which comes to mind is the field of alchemy, the alchemist.
Oh, yes.
And that's to do with the elemental side of science. So earth, wind, fire, water, and quintessence. And you're absolutely right. With the current Western tools that are available, it cannot be measured. And then I would ask, why does it need to be measured? Why is it you always have to know through your mind how this works? It's a sense of control that has to happen. Once you can put that information out there, you can control people through that knowledge. But this element within Western science called the quintessence is the fifth element, and that cannot be measured by the tools. Earth, wind, fire, and water are very absolutely would be established as like, oh yes, those are.
Wait, no, you said quintessence, and I was like, I've heard that word, but not in that as part of that group. But very often.
Yeah.
And what? So can you tell us more what it means?
So quintessence is a field of a huge field of light, and science does know this. In fact, what I was fascinated by was the scientists, in particular from NASA, because they work actually with light fields all the time. But they don't necessarily share it back to the rest of the world because they probably think we won't understand. However, there has been some snippets of very well-written literature that has, you know, come past many of us. And one is called Hands of Light. She was a scientist within the NASA.
Yeah.
And, yeah, she talks very clearly about the energies of light forces that work within the body and the body consciousness, and she was able to express them and explain them really clearly. And I said, yes, of course. I just said, yeah, fascinating, but so true. But that was directly from a highly scientific field that's not widely known or shared because people don't pick up
is it?
I mean, that kind of literature, really, as a matter of like a newspaper.
I guess another word for light is energy as well, so people might latch onto that word easier.
Energy.
Yeah.
Yes, that's a field too, very what do you call, known by Māori and experienced. So experiential knowledge, energy has a vibration or a frequency.
Yeah.
This is a frequency. Radios are a frequency. Have a frequency.
Yes. Yeah. We know all about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We know, but we can't see it, and we can't touch it, and we can interfere with it, and we can change it. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
We're not going to though.
But you know what I mean. It's so we can take that and go, oh well, you know, yeah, it's a frequency. So a frequency is a vibration, and what they do in Western science is measure it, and they can transfer that knowledge into what they call light codes.
Yep.
They can actually give it a coding of which light ray it is, because light has different colour spectrums.
Yeah, and that relates to the frequency.
Yeah, and it's definitely a field within Te Ao Māori that was dominant pre-European and understood by the Tohunga because of their way of working.
So how do you describe that way of working? We've got
pre-European?
We've got 2 minutes. No, joking. We've got time. We've got some time.
How do you describe that way of working? Well, if you dedicate your life to a particular body of mātauranga, or you are given some of that when you're growing up, by the time you're a young adult, your mind systems and your experiences are infused with that knowing. You know, you kind of, I guess we would call it, you know stuff, but you also are trained into it. So you become trained into it in the different schools of teaching.
And so, if you're someone who's a healer, what are you looking for? What are you on the alert for when someone ill comes to you?
One of the most obvious transitions of information that comes very clearly is when you see a person, there's a sense of smell. There's not so much taste. You don't taste them. But okay. You use a number of senses to first, you know, body language, receptivity to what you're offering. You know, you say, oh, we're going to open with karakia. First of all, you know that if they're coming to you, they want more than what they've got from their GP or other practitioners.
Yeah.
And so they are more open and receptive to what you are offering. So you sense that willingness to be receive what you have to offer. So you don't really diagnose, I would say for myself, you don't diagnose them.
Yeah, well, the doctors are looking for symptoms that can point to a diagnosis, and then a treatment follows from there. Yeah, right. Yeah, and we all understand that because that's we've all.
Do we?
Oh, yeah. Well, I do. I understand. That's what I expect to happen when I go to the doctor, right? They want to know the symptoms, then they can put that together and say this is the diagnosis, and then they work up a treatment. But so that's that system. But you're doing something else.
Yeah, you're not. You definitely don't make a diagnosis immediately. That's dangerous. I think that's probably why Western sciences doesn't work very well, exactly because of that, because they pile drugs one on top of the other. So my younger brother, you know, I said, how many pills have you got? Are you on, bro? Yeah. He's on 12 every day.
Well.
You know, he's a young man, and I'm going, how does that work? He said, oh, I don't know. Really? He said, all I know is I don't feel very well.
Yeah, and that can be, and there are people with stories like that, and it can be because the science is, it comes in down into more and more detail. There's a specialist for each little bit, and each little bit gets a separate diagnosis and a separate prescription.
Very dangerous.
And that does, yeah. And there's people who've, there's a guy who runs Soleno Health, and he had that story himself. He's a scientist, and he had that happened to him in his life, and it changed his approach. Like, he's a medical scientist. And completely changed how he viewed his own treatment in the scientific and the medical world, and so now he's trying to incorporate the bigger picture, the holistic approach. We use the word holistic, yeah. And I guess does that make sense to you? Is that what you're doing? Is that's a holistic approach?
Yeah, I think the holistic approach really means that you're not always diagnosing towards giving people a mineral or a pharmaceutical medicine.
Yeah. Yeah,
because that's dangerous. It was yet to be fully proven, but you're actually very toxic when you're taking medication, and we know that as practitioners, that you're filling your body with a number of pharmaceutical drugs that actually don't match, and yeah, of course you're sick. You're going to be even sicker because your body can't actually absorb and excuse me. As such, I think. The word holistic is still needs more understanding because there's a number of ways that come together for a kairongoa and others, many others, to understand, you know, like there's practitioners who use the different pulses of the body as a diagnostic tool.
So what does that mean, the different pulses?
So you have different pulses within your body because you have different meridian lines, and that's a fact. It's just Western science doesn't want to take it on board as thoroughly because it's requires time, actually requires a lot more time to transfer that knowledge to the practitioner, and they can read your body amazingly accurately and talk about the organ wealth, the organ health, and then treat it through, acupuncture.
Yeah, so I was going to say this has similarities with traditional Chinese medicine.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's a very thorough science. It can't be, you know, it's...
There is Western science that's catching up with that. No, talking
catching
about...
Catching up?
Yeah, we're finding the... What can I say? That's where it's at. Like they're finally, you know, like every cell is magnetic, and it creates what they call in the Western science constructive interference with the magnetism.
Well, electromagnetic. Like
every cell has a pole, right? A plus and a minus.
Yeah.
And so the body, they describe it as creating constructive interference, which creates meridian lines.
Yeah. So
someone's probably howling at their radio at the moment, but that's my brief memory understanding of it. Like, I know that there's been research into it.
Using the electromagnetic field is a given, you know? The Earth has electromagnetic field. So, therefore, the humans that live on the Earth and all other beings have a sensory magnetic field which moves in a circular, cyclic way depending on where they're located on the compass point of the Earth. That's a fact. But how we use that in indigenous science, we understand what that means to us. But in the Western world, they want to first, diminish it into a scientific...
Reduce, because it's a reductive science. So, and that's not, sometimes people think that's an insult, but it's just a description of the science. Like it reduces it to its smallest component to understand it. So if we can tie all this back in, because it is interesting to try to conceive of the worldview that's really different, having grown up with the Western view, like most of us have, that there's a whole different approach, and I'm just intrigued by what you're looking for, and you're talking about, it's obviously a more holistic approach. Traditional Māori culture didn't have scientific tools of cutting into people, or maybe they probably could cut into people if they wanted to, but that's not how the medicine worked. So it was about what you could see on the outside, but also what you could pick up in other ways, I guess.
Oh, we had a long history of knowing the inner parts of the body, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was, you know, I mean, when you go back into indigenous peoples, I mean, the Egyptians were known as some of the most highly regarded brain surgeons in the world for their science. That's in Egypt.
How did they do that?
Wow, look at the way they mummify their bodies. That's an extremely intense process of what they do.
But with like, you talk about brain, working on the brain, like, so the only model I know is the Western high-tech view, really high-tech. And it saved my mother's life a few years ago, so I wouldn't want to diss it, like, after she had some head trauma.
Mm.
But how does that work? Yeah, what's the picture?
Well, I'm
on
not
that?
Really.
Within, I guess you're not the expert on Egyptian.
Not on that particular aspect, because it belongs to the Egyptian people. I mean, you know, there are many indigenous cultures that were evolved within different scientific fields, indigenous science, and that's you know, yet to be acknowledged. It's not. We don't have to prove it. It has to be acknowledged that the body that is held by the Western people is definitely not all there is to the world.
It must be in the process of being acknowledged, because there are staff at Waikato University whose expertise is in Matauranga Māori. So,
yeah, those are not the only what we call conduits for Matauranga Māori.
No, but it was just, I thought that was a sign of some degree of acknowledgement.
Yes, because the field of that we're, you know, when you put something into other places, you also, it gets looked at from various angles, but also from the limitation of the mind, of the Western mind, which doesn't serve many indigenous practitioners. We've always been like, nope, that's not how it works. Nope, we know that. Oh, how do you know? Well, how do you know? You know, you prove to, you know. So we get into a debate around the balance of whose knowledge is valued, and that's not healthy. That's not a healthy, that's why we're so westernized.
That's, you distracted in the battle then, instead of what you were doing in the first place.
Absolutely. Use the true, is really know your enemy. And then you know how to do battle. Don't be distracted.
Oh, I see. Oh, right.
Yeah. Which is the science. It's not the people.
Yeah. So, yeah. So that, obviously, yeah. Okay, all right. So that's a whole thing that's going on.
Yeah.
I'm trying to, like, without actually being able to speak Māori, trying to understand what that world how that worldview works.
Yeah, and it's very hard because much of our mātauranga was also held within Big Stories cosmology, which is Pakiwaitara, and then in Pūrākau, which are the stories that are known within a tribal area, which are specific to their life.
And this is something you want to talk about this morning, so this is perfect, yes.
Yeah, so Pakiwaitara are the big cosmology stories. So one of the things we acknowledge now is how Māori adapted and were able to see the missionaries and the way they taught their stories, their Bible stories.
Yeah.
And we could feel a kin to them.
Mm.
It's because we were already spiritual beings. We had much processing of karakia and invocation, and you know, we were always paying attention to those aspects of who we were to enable us to be here in the first place through, you know, extremely long incantations and connection with different beings within the natural world, like the whales, you know, the tohora. Those were very real. All those, the stingray, which is one of the kaitiaki, you know, kaitiakitanga.
Yeah.
There's nothing like that in the Western science. But Māori understood that those relationships with those parts of te ao, the world, were extremely important to our going forward. But now they're held as like, oh, that's so, you know, Whale Rider touched on it. The whales, you know, the relationship of the Ngāti Porou people or Paikia and how they arrived here. There's many stories along those lines which are not heard because the Western world brought their lullabies and storytelling from Europe, from the Grimm's fairy tales, and nothing to do with us. We just went, what do you mean Little Red Riding Hood got a head chopped off and there was a fox?
Some of that, I got a copy of the Grimm's fairy tale book ages ago, years ago, and I looked at it, and some of the stories in there made no sense to me. Like, there's the ones that we know. The ones that we know make some degree of sense, but some of them didn't follow any kind of narrative. That it was weird. Some of it was just like, why was that even a story? So we're far removed from that culture now in modern times.
But they're still being articulated within the small minds of children.
Well, that's part of the cultural replacement that happened with colonization, though, isn't it? Like that was the point of it, was to bring those stories in and make those the stories that everyone was raised on.
Yeah, clean the slate off from, you know, Māori. But the Māori indigenous mythology is so interesting and so fascinating because it aligned also biblically and back to the Vedas, the ancient Vedic scriptures.
Oh, yes.
So the battle of the human family is a battle of, you know, good and evil, so-called good and evil.
Yeah, this is a cosmology.
Yeah, and cosmologically that has been a science within all of our backgrounds, which has happened since we arrived on the earth. It's something that we've, because good and evil, light and dark, so there's many polarities that it's given names as well, coexist. And so there's a battle for the light to be overcome the darkness.
So are there some, because we do know some of the traditional Māori stories in the wider culture here. Are there some examples of that you could remind us of?
How do you mean? The
big cosmological stories.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. There's I'll just use it as an example, the hongi. So the original hongi, the very first time that the breath was passed from between humans, was the cosmology of Tāne Mahuta putting life into Hine Uku, who was Hine Ahuone. So he breathed life through the breath. But that breath was a cosmological breath. So it was a story to, metaphorically, to express to us the life force exists in the one breath. But that's a big story for people to understand, but not for the Western mind it is. For the East, it's like easy. They go, yes, of course.
Well, it's a new way of it's a different way of looking at it for us
for the
Western
mind.
Yeah, so you don't and you're going to miss the subtlety. You're going to miss the subtleties if you don't spend time with it.
Well, Adam and Eve, you know, that's a pretty crazy story. Like,
it's pretty wacky. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, but we saw the aspects of it when, you know, Samuel Marsden arrived and started telling us about Adam and Eve, and we went, oh, yep.
But you can see the purpose that, yeah, the worldview that created that sin is inevitable. And these are my words here, and I know Christian people who, and they'll just make a casual reference to that. Something crazy's happened somewhere, and it's just a casual reference to sin. And I'm not saying right or wrong about that. I'm just saying that's how that operates as a story in their lives that explains things.
Yes,
and they can quickly refer to it, and it makes sense to them, but not necessarily to people outside of their faith.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it got all messed up in terms of what they call the Tree of Knowledge, which was extremely real aspect of esoteric knowledge.
Yeah, we've just had a bit of water spilled here, so we're going to stop and soak it up.
Yeah,
I was trying to see if I could just pretend it like on air, not let anyone know, and just talk while I was also pulling out some tissue paper, and that just wasn't happening for me. So
thank you.
We'll talk about it.
And so it's those stories of Rangi and Papa.
That's the one that everybody knows.
And
yeah.
The, you know, Te Wehinga, the separation and coming into the light would definitely metaphoric stories and cosmological happenings that gifted us the life that we journey on now.
So what don't we understand? What are the subtleties or the nuances about the story of Papa and Rangi?
Oh my gosh.
Give us a couple maybe.
Transgression is not part of that story.
Okay,
so transgression is a very dark force, and it makes people, diminishes the human being to you're wrong until you're proven right.
So as opposed to the concept of original sin and Adam and Eve and the snake and all the apple and
all
that.
Well, you pay for the rest of your life, don't you? And then you become...
Yeah. So this Papa and Rangi, that's not what it's about.
No, that doesn't articulate that at all. It doesn't diminish you to a place of you're a wrongdoer.
Where does it put you? Like,
so
where are you?
It places you within the world map of the family as understanding that you're the taina of tuakana taina, which is the elders and the younger sibling. We are actually always the taina because we arrived last in the cosmology. So our teachings are held within nature as one aspect, but if we care to learn. If we care to take into account these phenomena that we see. I think somebody, Tukana, my dear friend last night, mentioned, she said, I saw aurora in the deep south.
Mm.
I mean, we don't consider that a phenomena, but it's a phenomena.
Yeah.
What am I trying to say? That the human, it's a greater force than we would ever produce as a human family. It's what does it teach us? What does it show us?
So you use the phrase, their human family, and that the story of Papa and Rangi places you, and what you've just described gives you a place in a family.
Yeah.
And that's the big picture.
That's the big
picture. That you're
picture.
Part of a family that will nurture you, would that be, will look after you?
Yes, you're definitely what we call in the whakaruruho, a special environmental place as the world.
Yeah,
and it has so much to offer and nurture us with, but we're always destroying it.
Well, yeah, that's a problem.
Home.
That's a problem. Yes, yeah,
that's a big problem.
We have picked up on that recently. Yeah, yeah.
So if it's our home, and for now, as a human being, but we continually diminish that by our practices because we want to dominate it. so we clear it. And then we also don't give attention to the animal kingdom as we should, because, you know, we continually take the fins off sharks. You know, that can't possibly be a good practice for us.
Yeah, well, that's something that's the money system at its most ruthlessly logical extreme, I would say. So that's a little bit of the bigger
introduction to the cosmology, the that was pictures. Understood by Māori of the evolution, the original story of Papa Tuanuku and Rangi Nui, and the evolution of that the human family to be here.
But you also talked about little stories.
So a pūrākau would be a story about Tutanekai, Henemo and Tutanekai, because that occurred in a place.
Yeah.
It didn't happen in the far north, or it didn't happen in the far south. It belongs to the Te Arawa people.
In Rotorua.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's a pūrākau that happened there. So, yeah. So it's their story, really.
So what's the purpose of the little stories?
Well, storytelling is an ancient practice of all cultures, and it's a way of helping children and adults understand the world they are in, and gives them gives you really I guess it's, you know, it's storytelling to enrich who you are, and you feed from those stories, or you remember them, or you remember the colour of you know what they were wearing, or the instrument that was played, like in Tutanekai and Henemoa, it was a kōwowo, but you won't know that's a kōwowo unless somebody's told you that that's a traditional Māori flute, and you go, oh. So then you perhaps can imagine the melodious sound of the kōwowo, and maybe you've experienced it as well, and you go, oh, that sound. And then you know, you really breathe the story. It comes alive. Maybe you even enact it.
It's interesting because I lived there for my last 2 years of school, and there's a Tutanekai Street, and there's a Henemoa Point, and the island in the middle of the lake is
Mokoia.
Yeah, yeah, it's somehow part of it as well.
Oh, absolutely. So, well, there's the point, the puna.
Yeah, so you find yourself living within the story.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which was interesting.
And it's peculiar. The personalities of the stories are infused into the people.
So what do we learn from that, or what do people get from that story?
Yeah, what do they get? Yeah, well, they get a sense of aroha, and how that aroha was expressed through the voice of a flute, and you know the magic of music. That was part of that, and her intention. And the way that she transversed a body of water to follow the sound of the flute, the flute or kōwowo.
Yeah, yeah.
To, you know, so it's a love story. It's a story of calling, using a very magical musical instrument, an ancient instrument, and then how that connection is made, and then you know it's it expresses that, really. You know Romeo and Juliet, similar, not the same, but yeah,
same but different.
Same but different.
So what do you see as, like, imagine you're as a Maori anthropologist coming from Mataranga Maori, looking at Western movies, can you look at them in the same way, and what stories, what underlying things are you getting out of those maybe you don't watch?
Oh, definitely. Like, I'm really glad that we're not looking at so many Americanized movies, because they're full of destruction, and they seem to like blowing up things and
yeah,
right from the beginning, yeah. and it tells you a lot about the karma. Well, back to this thing of karma of a country.
Yeah.
America has an extremely dark karma, you know, because it produces that kind of film for the rest of the world to watch. But within it is darkness. It's a reflection of their lack of ability to have a sense of calm within an underlying principle in their scripting. They're full of it. It's just terrible what they're gifting to the world. Like, why would I want my grandchildren to watch that when they can watch other more wholesome animated stories, you know, that come from Japan and Spain that tell other stories that I can relate to about a culture and the type of music that's used. It's a layered expression, isn't it? You've got this music that dominates the film. You've got the languaging, the way that it's scripted. Cowboys and Indians.
Let's not go there. We haven't got enough time to go into that.
Let's not do that.
I played Cowboys and Indians when I was like eight. So, yeah, that was...
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, and so, yeah, as I've grown up...
Yeah.
I think I've come to understand, that's not healthy. Those films are diminishing a whole culture.
And there's something I remember reading a long time ago now about the stuff that we're familiar with, the stories that we're familiar with follow a pattern of there's a conflict and good over evil, and someone dominates, they get into conflict and end the other side, like defeat them. So you got a problem, you find the enemy that caused the problem and you defeat them. That's the story arc for most of our movies and things like that and our stories. And this article I was reading was talking about, I think it was Japanese culture, but I'm not sure, or different ways of telling a story where...
Absolutely.
So it's not the only way you can tell a story, that there has to be conflict and an enemy and a defeat. That sometimes the stories are a little bit like there's a twist in the tale. That's the magic of the story there, that the resolution doesn't come from a defeat, but from there's a twist in the tale and a surprise.
Yeah. Yeah, so yeah. True. I think it's in the scripting and how they've been taught to script and what they bring to that preparation for a film if that's their work. Yeah, absolutely. I've absolutely found that.
I wonder what
watching movies with my grandchildren.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going, whoa, this is cool.
But I wonder what it creates. It almost designs the culture or creates a culture where whenever there's a problem, you look for someone did this to me, or there's an enemy out there that needs to be defeated to solve this.
Oh, you mean like, Star Wars?
Well, but maybe that's how we live our lives too, because we've all grown up watching these stories over and over, the same story every time, which is there's a problem, there's an enemy that caused it, and we have to defeat the enemy. And it creates a pattern in our minds that we're probably completely unaware of. And we think that's how problems are solved. If there's a problem, find the enemy and defeat them.
Subconsciously, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Like how ingrained is that in our culture? I'm just wondering this now.
Well, it's a very powerful form of messaging, isn't it? To have film in our lives.
That's why it was interesting to ask you, as someone who's in touch with another culture, to view our culture from that culture.
I don't like the American expression at all. I find them very quite egotistical in their filmmaking. Yeah. You know, they always have heroes and heroines, and also the personification of what beauty is and handsome is, and those elements. I don't like it at all.
Yeah.
I find it really, really destructive to, you know, to the human presence of the feminine and the masculine, female and male and the others.
And we could probably talk for hours about the effects of the modelling of what a heroic male is.
Yeah, well, you've got male, female, but you've also got the in-between, you know. It's a genderless. That part of the world is only just becoming more understood. And that's a really real part of historically, but it was not expressed, definitely not expressed in film. Oh my goodness, no.
Well, no. No, they're not in the last couple of hundred years.
Polarity was the only way.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, Ngaronoa, we've come to the end of the show, and we've ended up, as usual, we end up talking. It's an interesting thing to do because I don't really have access to the Māori culture, not like the way you do, like not the depth of understanding. So I'm always trying to find a way to communicate what you understand into ways that I understand. I hope people get something out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not easy. Like, it's not an easy thing to do, I feel.
No, but I do find it myself, you know, that exchange of a bridge as a bridge to look back at my, reflect on my own understandings and go, well, yeah, they are understandings, but then I can also receive and project.
Yeah.
I find that it's a very useful tool.
But now it's time to stop, according to the clock.
Oh,
but do you want to tell us, because you've got your, have you got your class tomorrow at the old school?
So I'm doing a time bank class at the community centre on the 18th in the afternoon of Te Reo Māori.
Okay.
And then after Labour weekend, I'll be offering a, kura pō, which is an evening class in Te Reo. So it'll be total immersion.
Those are coming up as well.
Yeah, after Labour weekend. We've got to get through.
Are you still doing the Whānau Waiata workshops?
No, those have completed
now.
Oh,
they've completed. Okay, yes, we'll get those off our What's On guide.
Yes, please do.
Glad I checked.
All right. I can't tell you the venue, but Te Reo will be my best story to tell.
Okay. Oh, well, let us know when you've got all the details pinned down and we'll let everyone know.
Ai, kia ora.
Thanks for coming in.
Ai, ka kite anō koutou, mā.
All right, folks, that's the end of the show for the day. We'll see you all again tomorrow morning.